This is talking with Tom Gold at the AAS meeting in Haverford on 24th June 76. Now, can you tell me when you first became aware of this new field of radio astronomy and so forth?
Well, Hoyle and Bundy and I had discussed possibilities, various areas of radio astronomy during the war when we were working together on radar.
Oh, really?
We were, of course, all three of us in the theory division that in the Admiralty very much concerned with what we were all three interested in astronomy and very much concerned with what would come of radio methods.
Well, I didn't know that. You were all in the same group.
Yes,
in a radar lab.
In
amazing.
Radar, yes.
What sort of theory did you work on there?
Hoyle on radio propagation, I on reflection properties of various things like aeroplanes and the rough sea and things like that.
Amazing.
And that's where we got to know each other.
I see. And you knew about Jansky's and Reber's work?
A little, but it was only a sort of, in those days it was not yet, had not yet sort of been, come to be regarded as a groundbreaking new field. It was just some strange effects that had been observed. I remember very clearly observing on a radar set that I was running, observing the interference caused by the sun, and thinking and discussing with my colleagues then how interesting it would be to you if I was only allowed to use that same instrument
right
just for the solar studies.
This was after Hayes' discovery?
Yes. But it was very obvious this was a 10 centimeter radar set. I had no trouble at all observing at disturbed times the sun.
Now, what was the nature of the discussions that you had?
Well, we discussed what kind of instruments one would build and what one would do. And also we were very much concerned with what one could do in the solar system with radar. And I remember then discussing that one would want to build a very large vertical, essentially vertical looking dish.
A hole in the ground?
A hole in the ground idea. It was already then. Very much discussed. I discussed it for various purposes, including radar to the moon and the planets. We worked out approximately what it would take, and it was clear that you needed very large instruments. Receivers were not as good then as they now are, and so the calculations came somewhat bigger than they now turned out to be. But that was all discussed then.
Were there any British attempts right after the war to bounce off the moon like the American?
Unfortunately not. In fact, I pressed very much for that, and I had written a paper, secret of course in those days, but now after that many years I'm sure I can say it in public. I'd written a paper advising the Admiralty that they could make a secret communication channel to their distant ships at sea by bouncing off via the moon.
The moon circuit, yeah.
And said that if at a high frequency they merely looked from a ship at the moon, it would not give away their position, even if they transmitted and it was received back home. It was much harder to position find on a beam directed upwards.
Right. But this would have required an incredibly higher gain, though, than...
Well, the dish they could have built back home at the Admiralty could have been a pretty big one, and then the satellite object does not have to be all that big.
Yeah, that's true.
I had, however, not thought, when I wrote that paper, I said that, of course, it will mangle the speech by the different delay times because of the big size of the moon. And I had not appreciated, or couldn't, of course, then appreciate, just how smooth the moon's surface at longer wavelengths would be. And as it turns out now, at 10 centimeters you can in fact communicate speech.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mangle it too badly. It mangles it a bit, but not too badly. So it in fact was better than I had claimed it would be.
Very interesting. You said that you discussed, besides the radar, you discussed what one would do and what sort of instruments one would build for radio astronomy, but can you just tell me a little bit more details of what directions you were thinking?
Well, we were just essentially just thinking about the types of antennas that we built for radar purposes and how one would use larger versions of them for radio astronomy.
And but what about from the astronomy side? What did it seem like would be most promising to investigate?
that we didn't get in there.
Yeah.
And we knew that the sun would be interesting, and we knew the radar would be interesting. And then we had heard that there was some radiation from the galaxy, but I suppose that we then thought mostly, as most people then did, that that would be just some diffuse gas component in the galaxy would radiate a little and that would be the end of it. Because, you know, we didn't really realize it. But a wealth of new information that was going to be there. At least, I don't remember that we really appreciated that.
Well, then what happened when the war ended?
Well, then the three of us all returned to Cambridge, and we started to interest ourselves in cosmology. And although we were all three cognizant of radio methods, we somehow did not manage to get anything organized. I was very keen to become a radio, whatever it was then, radio astronomer, but I had no real opportunity. And I was too junior still to make my own arrangements, and so I didn't succeed.
Why not get involved with Ryle's fledgling group?
Because that was a little bit too much of an in-group already then. Radcliffe was running it in those days, and I had, to say the least, rather poor relationship with Radcliffe. Radcliffe was a very stern man and a big organizer he was, and from the beginning I didn't get on with him, chiefly because I had first had a plan to leave the Admiralty and get to Cambridge on the basis that I was expert in ultrasound devices, having developed them for Doppler radar, where I'd built the Mercury delay lines, and so I'd become quite knowledgeable in that. And I thought that I would like to build an instrument which is now after 30 years or whatever it is, has now become, only just now, a most interesting thing, namely a medical instrument to give a pictorial display of an ultrasonic reflection pattern. Mm-hmm. And I argued that indeed you could look into somebody's inside and use it like x-rays, you see. And I also had argued that one could use it for looking through metal components for cracks.
Mm.
And indeed it is very good for that, much better than x-rays, of course, because to find cracks with x-rays is difficult because they don't introduce any extra opacity, you see.
Yes, yes.
Unless you look along the crack, you don't find it with x-rays. Mm-hmm. With ultrasound, of course, they are completely opaque. A crack is just absolutely opaque. So I wanted to build such a thing and had already raised the money and had the agreement of the Cavendish that they would give me space and let me work there with my money that I had raised for the job and from a government agency. And just before I was to take up this job there, Radcliffe informed me that he had a recent look over the space problems in the Cavendish, and he found that there was no possible accommodation for me, and so he had to turn me down, me and the money and this job. Had he not turned me down, I would claim that I would have produced exactly this instrument that we now have after this long time, because that was exactly what was the program then.
Well, anyway, this sort of thing drove you to theory,
I didn't
take it.
Didn't put me into the Radcliffe camp anyway.
And there wasn't much else. That was the only game in town, really.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, then we worked on various theoretical matters, and then we had the sort of colloquia meetings where the radio astronomers presented their story, and were frequently, as I think Edge reports, were frequently minor sort of tussles between Hoyle, myself on the one side, and Ryle and some of his group on the other side.
Now, starting when now are you?
Starting in 49.
When the first 49. Few radio sources were beginning to be found and identified.
Yes.
And
that's right.
And how would you sort of summarize the nature of these tussles?
Well, the one outstanding one that I remember clearly is that Hoyle and I made at one, I think, evening meeting, made in, I think, in perfectly good taste a suggestion of how one could sort out some particular puzzle that was left from a discussion that Ryle had given us. Mm-hmm. Ryle had told us he'd observed this and the other, and we said what I thought was perfectly normal etiquette. We said, well, couldn't you observe so and so, then you would settle that question. Mm-hmm. And instead of saying, yes, that's a good suggestion, or yes, we thought of that before and we will do it, or yes, yeah, yes, we can't do it for one reason or another, instead of saying that, he was absolutely annoyed and he said, well, you can go out and drag the cables all over the ground to do this work.
Yeah.
It wasn't our business to drag the cables over the ground.
Right.
But
right,
he was just annoyed that we should at all interfere with it, to the extent even of making some suggestions, mm-hmm, which evidently were not erroneous suggestions, otherwise he would have tackled that, you see.
Yeah,
he would have,
yeah,
clearly been able to say, well, no, that's no damn, yeah, good. No, they said, you can go out and drag the cables over the ground to set it up. So there was a sort of air of annoyance any time we opened our mouths, and it was always clear, as every other observer of the scene has of course described, it was always clear that the Ratcliffe organization was a very closely organized system. They didn't like to talk to anybody outside about anything. A few of them did, but did so very sort of sheepishly. I mean, you know,
yeah,
you know, some of them would be quite friendly with me and talk to me. But I came fairly soon to be recognized as somebody who had a role to play. You
right,
see,
yeah,
and so whether somebody knew me or didn't was of some concern.
Right. And so I guess you would say that, or would you, that the present reputation which the Cambridge group has in radio astronomy of secrecy and so forth grew directly out of the ionosphere group, Ratcliffe?
Yes.
But
absolutely.
Now,
I mean, I suppose that Ryle went along with that in the first place and then yeah, augmented it later.
Yeah. What was the scientific nature of these tussles primarily? Did you have basic agreements there? Was it only a matter of philosophy in any sort of suggestion that you made?
I think the first major matters of disagreement were the two items that you know. One was the discussion in 51 or 52. When was the IAU in Rome?
52.
Well, it was previous to that.
So, the 52 Rome meeting.
Well, before that, you see, was the meeting in London, a massy, organized meeting at University College, at which radio astronomy, what was then known, was discussed pretty thoroughly, and it was there Ryle presented what he thought was the evidence that there was, that the sources that he'd observed, 50 about by then,
right, the ones
that they were on a scale of stars and at distances like stars from us. That they were on stellar scale, and that his evidence showed that very clearly. And then I got up and I said, well, I can't believe that's what the evidence is, because all that you can really say is the angular distribution around us, and if that's reasonably isotropic as it was, then I can either believe that they're very close, like you say, or that they're very far, so that they're outside the galaxy. And
right. But Ryle must have considered that they might be very far too,
and he not
liked it because of too much power required, or...
And that's right. And he said, oh, but the power requirements are absolutely outrageous. And my reply to that was, well, we know of some galaxies that are very different from our own, that have greatly broadened emission lines. That was stated then.
The Seyfords.
Well, whatever they were, they weren't, I think, given a name yet.
But they give.
But Seifert's paper was in during the war, 42.
Well,
or
that
so
could be, but I don't think
they weren't called that anyway. No.
But in any case, I said there existed galaxies greatly broadened emission lines, suggesting that enormously violent activity went on in them, and I was not one to say that they could not be producing that much more power than ordinary galaxies.
Yeah, yeah.
And in any case, I said that you'd have to have more power for the star story. You would have to have a certain factor in power up on a star. For the galaxy story, you have to have a certain power up in the galaxy, and I couldn't tell which one of those two was more likely than the other. Ryle replied to that. He said the theoreticians have misunderstood the nature of the evidence, and so on. He was absolutely adamant that he had proved that they were not extragalactic. And then I merely insisted that both were possibilities, and that really there's some evidence for thinking that very different galaxies occur. Yes, you better look at that, because that, I think, was the sort of best discussion.
Is there a proceedings of this meeting somewhere?
Yes.
I've never seen that.
I have it, yeah.
Do you know where? Was it a separate book? Or?
As I say, Edge reports substantial parts of it.
So it's a separate
Edge,
volume?
If you have Edge's book, you'll find a lot of it
I'll
reported
check.
There. But it was not printed, but it was duplicated.
Oh, I see.
And I have one of the duplicated copies of it.
How many pages is it? I think I might
like to get... Oh, it's quite thick. It's quite thick.
Well, I might like to get a Xerox copy myself. It sounds like it could be pretty valuable because it summarizes the state of the field at that time.
If you wanted just the radio astronomy parts Xerox, that's not so much. There was also a lot of geophysics, auroral stuff, and so on in the same meeting.
Right.
If you didn't want that, then the radio astronomy would maybe be a matter of... Oh, I would say 60 pages.
Oh, okay, that's quite reasonable, yeah.
Well, if you want to have that, I could have it Xeroxed, but you'd have to probably pay for the Xerox charge.
Sure. Okay.
Write to my office and they will...
I'll do that. I'll
and
do that.
They'll send you a Xerox. Write to my office and say the radio astronomy parts of the...
The Massey...
I'm not sure if it was 51 or 52 meeting. Well, then I'll tell you the story, which is a sort of pretty personal matter, but because we had this sort of very definite fight at that meeting that the sources could be extragalactic, it seems that because of that, Ryle was particularly upset when in Rome, Bade... waved me over as soon as he saw me in the antechamber to the meeting when I just arrived. He waved me over and said, look, Tommy, you'll be delighted. We have here the picture of the Cygnus colliding galaxies, as they called it. We have here the picture, and there's no question, he said, that we have identified that that is what the radio source is. And there's no question that the extragalactic, you'll be delighted to know, because he'd known that I had favored that point of view. So I looked at the pictures and I was delighted, and a moment later Ryle appears in the distance and Bade shouts over to him, hey Martin, come over here, have a look at this, you see. So Ryle comes over and is shown the picture and is given the same story, of course, to Bade. And I stand right by the side still, and I didn't make any very biting comment, but I said, well, something like, well, it seems that they could be extragalactic.
Yeah.
You know, just some slight reminder of what was, I think, a few months before. So I said, well, it seems that they could be extragalactic or something like that. And would you believe it, Ryle collapsed on a bench, on a settee in that room, buried his head in his hands and sobbed.
Incredible. But was this the first time he found out about this?
This was the first.
Wasn't there correspondence between Bade and Smith?
This was the first time that he was forced to believe the evidence. Until then, he'd believed that it was a misidentification.
I see.
This was the first time he really had to believe the evidence.
So he apparently had gotten so wound up with this interpretation, you're saying.
That it was such a matter of, I mean, he's a terribly emotional person. There was such a deep concern to him that they really were extragalactic and that he was wrong and I was right. And because he'd remembered the conversation and the fact that he'd been so biting before, saying that you've misunderstood the nature of the evidence.
But then it's rather interesting in things like the Bakerian lecture in 58 that Ryle becomes the chief proponent to show that they must be extragalactic.
Not only extragalactic, but much further than...
cosmological,
absolutely,
right.
Well, he was always on the side of passionately wanting his objects to be most dramatic. And in the first place, he thought if they were star-like things, he would have discovered that there was a whole new world as dense as stars of new things, you see.
Yeah.
And that had interested him more than that an occasional galaxy should be of any kind. But then, having to have it that it was galaxies, then he preferred to think that they were extremely far and therefore were the most valuable cosmological tool. And then, of course, his only case that they were far was if the gradient was not three halves.
Right.
If the gradient
was
three halves, well, then you wouldn't know what distance they were.
No.
Incidentally, at that same meeting, I also said that as an argument that I thought argued against it being star-like objects, I said that if they were star-like objects, then I would imagine it most probable that they would be collapsed stars, just because the high density allows strong magnetic fields to exist and allows the fields to extend into gases of lower density. And that, I said, was a particularly favorable circumstance for radio emission. I said, all that's all in the book. And
this
then
is before the synchrotron mechanism was
yes,
proposed.
Yes. And I said, that was a particularly favorable mechanism for radio emission. I would have imagined that it's those stars that you would be seeing if they were stars. But in that case, I said, I would be very surprised to find them steady and not fluctuating with time constants appropriate to such small objects.
Amazing.
So this really is absolutely a prescription for the pulsars, except I did not say the regularity of them.
Incredible. But now, what were you thinking of for the emission mechanism? Something like solar flares? But no, they were steady, though.
No, the flares were bursts. And solar flares were, of course. But what I had in mind was that you needed big gradients of electron density and you needed big accelerations of electrons to make radiation. And without understanding in detail how you jiggle the electrons, I knew that a vacuum tube will produce radiation in radio bands if you have a lot of electrons that suffer a high acceleration and if there's a large gradient of electron density, because if there's a tenuous electron gas extending out from there, then the radiation doesn't get out.
Right.
So that much I understood. And that was my picture, the nearest to a vacuum tube that makes radio waves that I could think of was to have a very strong field that has electrons in it, and then I would have imagined
how
they could
be. It's a shame you didn't really publish in this game at this time, in terms of interpretation, because these sort of thoughts were not being thought very much at this time.
That's right,
In print, anyway.
That's right. Well, as I say, it is at least in that document, so that it's all there. And then I also said at the same meeting that the galactic radiation, Ryle wanted to attribute the diffuse galactic radiation to the same stellar sources unresolved, the summation of them in the galaxy unresolved.
Right.
And I argued against that point by saying I could perfectly well imagine that as a small byproduct, and energetically I said it would be only a small byproduct of the cosmic rays, that there would be, if there was any mechanism for converting a tiny fraction of the cosmic ray energy into radio waves, that would account for it.
Yes, I remember that comment. That's in one of the observatory things I had.
And that, of course, is also correct. It's also turned out.
You didn't explicitly say if there were an electron component.
No, because I did not really know. I was not really clear what the mechanism was.
Yeah.
Before synchrotron, one didn't really understand how one was going to make it anyway.
Sure.
But I just thought if the cosmic rays in going through a plasma make it a little noisy in some way.
It's a lot of energy there,
Tiny fraction of the energy converting that plasma in some way into radio waves, and it would be sufficient, I said. So therefore, with that discrepancy in the energy, I didn't really think that it was necessary to invent another.
Now, what about, we're getting to the stage of the log n log s, Going back even before that, had there been talk, of course there had always been the Galaxy Count business and controversies with how well you could do that, but when the radio sources came along, they turned out to be isotropic, and at least you were thinking that they might well be extragalactic. Did you think that this might be a good test?
Well, yes. We thought a great deal about galaxy counts, and it was quite clear that that would be so. Perhaps we were not as clear about the fact that even if one had no idea of the individual nature of the objects, that the statistics, especially many, could still be used. I think that I have to say that I did not think of that first myself. It was immediately clear to me when pointed out, but I don't think that I thought of that. That would be the way around. It would go for the radio sources. I don't think that I had understood. I don't know. I can't remember. But in any case, it was certainly immediately clear.
Yeah.
But it was also immediately clear, as I think I mentioned to you earlier, that if, a moment I thought about it then, that if any errors were made, that they would tend to steepen the curve.
Yeah, well, could you just say that again?
Yes. It was clear that if a uniform background and uniform in depth gives you the three halves law, that if you make no error for the strong sources, but make progressively more and more error for the weak sources, then even if each error that you make has an equal probability of going to the weaker as going to the stronger, when you measure the intensity of a source, it will mean that you'll always transport more sources from a weak category to a strong one, because there are more in the weak category, than vice versa. And so it means automatically that you will shift the upper part of the curve where you make errors, you will shift that over to the right, the lower part you have not shifted, and so therefore when you draw the line through it, you're going to have a steeper line. That we were clear about. And in fact, I remember visiting on one of the sort of slightly charged visits that I paid to Ryle's group in the Cavendish. I remember sitting in the Cavendish with Ryle and some of his people around to discuss this, and I said something like, well, how accurately can you measure the radio sources? Can you give me some estimate of the amount of error that you're likely to make, depending on the intensity, with this very point in mind, which I'd understood, but I had not discussed with them yet, you see. And so Ryle's first reply to that was the absolutely ridiculous one of saying, oh, well, the errors don't matter, don't you understand? It doesn't depend, the statistics don't depend on the on the errors. So I said, you mean to say the errors don't matter? Why bother to have a radio telescope at all? And you can just suck them out of your thumb, the figures. You know? And what are you doing if not measuring the intensities? So then he had to think again, and then it became clear that what in the statistics did not matter was the identification of the distance to any particular source.
The intrinsic luminosity distribution didn't.
The intrinsic luminosity distribution didn't affect the matter, but the measurement of it, of course, did.
Right.
If you make an error in the measurement, then it does affect it. Otherwise, you obviously wouldn't need to measure.
So while you say your recollection is that this was published.
My recollection is this was published.
But I don't remember it, and you can't remember where. And who were the authors again?
Sharma, Bandi, and myself, I think.
Okay, we'll have to check that.
I'm absolutely certain that we worked on this, and I have a recollection of a brief note being published. I'll check on it once more, but it is an item that I keep, but only in recent years, a complete bibliography, and every now and again we find some item of earlier years that's forgotten, and this was one of them that I sort of penciled in, and I said, well, we must identify that, and put it in, but it's not in.
Still haven't. Now, while the 2C survey was going on, were both Ryle and you and Hoyle thinking all the time that this was going to be a nice test, or was it sort of an afterthought that this could be, you could do some powerful cosmology with this. In other words, was it a driving thing for the 2C, or was it only when it was more or less being completed?
Well, I think that what we said then was we didn't believe the error situation of the Ryle story. We considered that it would be a valuable test specifically, and in some writings that he's in, specifically because of the steady-state universe giving you a precise prescription.
Right.
While in other cosmological theories, you would not have a prescription what you ought to be seeing.
You can always wiggle out.
You can always wiggle out on grounds of evolution, of how a galaxy evolves to make radio noise. We haven't a clue.
Yeah.
And so we said, well, specifically the steady-state is an important cosmological model for tests of that nature. And I still think to this day that that's the right attitude to take.
Very well defined as to its prediction in this case.
Yes.
And so was it a matter then that you were eagerly awaiting to see what the result of this was going to be?
Well, except after the very first announcement from Ryle's group with a gradient of over 3, which was immediately coupled to this being a final disproof of the steady-state theory, we were very suspicious of the veracity of this, and evidently correctly so.
Yeah.
As I say, having after that a meeting with him and finding out that he didn't even know...
Well, this meeting was after this...
After he first produced...
Brouhaha,
yes.
So public press and all that.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes, that was absolutely in the usual fashion of the Cambridge group that press announcement was the first thing we heard.
You knew there was a large survey going on, undoubtedly. Did you know that?
Not much. No, that was the first thing. And so after that, as I say, when I then met with him and I found that he didn't even understand that you really had to measure to a good accuracy in order to... You know. So that put me on the side then of saying, oh, well, I don't trust the data at all. If somebody produces this big noise without even having realized what the accuracy has to be before the thing works, I wasn't too impressed. And so I told Hoyle that, and I said, oh, you needn't believe any of that stuff, you see. But Hoyle is always much more cautious than I that way, and he always sort of says, oh, no, you... Well, he didn't like Ryle, but he always said, oh, but you must listen to the observers. If you don't listen to the observers, you're lost. And you know. And I said, well, I'll listen to them, but they have to be right. I mean, otherwise I take no... But Hoyle was much more concerned that these data were correct and that he had to invent new cosmologies to fit those data. And I just brushed them off and said, well, I don't believe they're right.
I see. So you didn't worry about finding other things, problems wrong
with? Whatever the state of affairs is now, it was quite clear that the gradient of 3 was absolute bunkum, wasn't it? Because if the gradient is now turns out to be 1.8, well, it's significant, maybe, but that's another story.
But it's not 3.
It's not 3, and the difference between 3 and 1.5 is nearly the same as the difference in 3 and 1.8.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no use saying now, oh, well, you see, it was indeed a steeper gradient. If it is, I'm still not sure, but... There's no use saying now.
Right.
It was really.
But are you saying then that there were no other major objections that you brought to the 2C survey results other than this one of the errors that you mentioned? Before Mills's results, of course, that changed the scene when they came.
Yes,
but before then.
Before then, we just discussed that the errors would be making it steeper, and that you didn't know about that correctly.
Yeah.
And then they had that Scheuer discussion, which we didn't really understand. That you didn't need to, didn't need anything, and still gave the... And that must have been wrong, too, because obviously that seemed to agree with the count, and then the count is now known to have been that wrong, so I don't know what was wrong.
This is very confusing. I haven't been through it all in detail. I think the P of D is basically correct, but its application to...
Well, at any rate, there must have been something wrong, because...
Yeah.
At the time, we were told, oh, well, if you do it the Scheuer way, you get the same answer. And now we know that answer...
Yeah.
If it was a gradient of 3, it was wrong. So it must have been something wrong with that, too. That's all I know.
So was the next major development when, indeed, the results from Australia came in? And what happened then? How do you remember? How did you get wind of those results, first of all?
Well, That digs a little deeper into my memory than I remember. I don't really remember.
I'm wondering, was there something before a preprint? Some meeting or something?
No, I don't think I had any particularly close contact in those days with the Australians.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I remember the 58 Paris
right.
meeting, where there was a straight head-on clash
right.
between Mills and Ryle. Wasn't
but that was a year or two after
yes.
the ingredients.
But yes, were there. Well, yeah. I don't really remember the
okay.
earlier phases.
But anyway, what happened when the word did get to England about this Mills survey, the first part of it anyway?
Well, the obvious thing is that we just thought, well, it's you know, going in the right direction, and it shows that you can't trust the Royal Survey.
And were you willing to trust the Mills simply because it gave the result that
well,
you wanted to see?
No, but I still insisted that the errors would always tend to steepen the curve, and so therefore anybody getting a flatter curve was more likely to be free from errors.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all. But
well, maybe you could tell me about this Paris Symposium. There's a couple of papers and some discussion that are recorded.
My main recollection of my own position at the Paris Symposium was not in relation to the Mills-Ryle story, because I was perfectly willing to let these characters fight that without mm-hmm. my intervening in any way, although I listened carefully to it, but that's all. But I remember then standing up for the viewpoint that the 21-centimeter observations did not reflect the gaseous mass in the galaxy, because it was more likely to be in molecular form.
I see.
And the only other person who was supporting this point of view at the symposium was Bart Bock. He remembers the story very well. He says to me every time. And now it has taken that many years until last year.
Yeah.
In 58, almost 20 years. Before that has now been shown to be true, because by now I think we're pretty clear about the fact that the bulk of the hydrogen is in molecular form.
Mm-hmm.
And that the 21-centimeter maps therefore refer to just those regions that presumably where the density is not high enough to
right.
make molecules.
Yeah. And the people, it was Oort, I suppose, the Dutch, who were saying that this was the gaseous component.
So, yes, I mean, yeah. in those years, it was every time that the 21-centimeter people discussed the gas in the galaxy, I would always say, the gas that happens to be left in atomic form.
Yes.
Right. I'd sit down again. Every time I would do that.
Now, were you thinking that this other gas might or might not show these features, which were called spiral arms?
Well, I thought that it would be in some patterns of this kind, too, but I wasn't sure that they would be
yeah,
the same patterns.
Right. It was just really a caveat that you were giving out every time.
Yes,
right.
yes.
Right.
And so I didn't want to have it said that that we've demonstrated where the spiral arms are in the galaxy from the 21-centimeter data.
Yeah.
It's not true. We haven't, in fact.
Now, when did you actually leave England and go to Harvard, I guess?
In 57.
And what was your job? At,
well, then I was at Harvard, and at the Harvard College Observatory as a professor, and one of my duties was to run the radio astronomy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which in those days just had the 60-foot dish.
Is this taking over from Bach, who
yes.
who was going to Australia?
Yes. And Menon was the
right.
sort of young man there. And there I organized that it was equipped with a Mazer, and I got Cooper from Australia, Brian Cooper, mm-hmm. and John Jelly from England.
Mm-hmm.
I got an NSF grant, and within a year, we had a brilliantly working Mazer at the focus of the telescope.
You were mainly running this show, not really directly involved yourself. In terms of dirty work, anyway.
Not in terms of dirty work, but you know, we had our weekly meetings and program and so on that organized.
Were you enthusiastic about this hydrogen line as a way to?
Oh yes.
What did you think were its main?
And in fact, when I left Harvard in '59 to go to Cornell, then director of the observatory, Donald Menzel, wrote me a very complimentary letter about the direction of the radio astronomy project mm-hmm. and the construction of the Mazer and what a marvelous thing it was, and how they were all pleased and proud of it and so on.
What do you see as the what did you see as the main things that could be done with the hydrogen line? Apparently, at Harvard there was not great surveys done like in Australia and Holland. There were more areas of star formation and so forth. But
yes.
Was this under your influence somewhat? Or?
Well, it certainly was a little under my influence in that I didn't feel that we were well set up for contributing with any organized survey work. We had just the undergraduate student who could spend a few hours out there and mm-hmm. very little staff, no great heavy organization, not like CSIRO or somebody.
Right.
And so I didn't want to steer into anything other than an individual student's program that he could do in a year and write a paper on it, that's all.
I should ask you why you came to the United States. You're an Englishman? Mm-hmm.
Yes. I came to the United States from a job as chief assistant at the Royal Observatory. So I left Cambridge in 1953 to become chief assistant at the Royal Observatory when Spencer Jones was the Astronomer Royal. And so I was the next one in charge, person down. And that suited me quite well, and I quite liked it. And then in 1956, Spencer Jones had to retire, and they appointed Woolley. And Woolley, as soon as he appeared on the scene, was so opposed to every area of work that was other than classical optical astronomy
mm-hmm.
that you wouldn't believe it. I just built what was called a neutron monitor, a solar cosmic ray measuring gadget. Mm-hmm. And there was the great flare of in February 1956. Which we had one of the best records, and I regarded it very appropriate for the Royal Observatory to have a long-term cosmic ray records, because like other things, there ought to be long-term records in existence, and this was the place to keep long-term records. This was exactly what the Royal Observatory was doing.
If you didn't do it, then no one would.
Yes, so exactly the thing. So we set up very excellent equipment, the best in the world. Built a little building for it and everything, and Woolley appeared on the scene. Cosmic rays? That's not astronomy.
Yeah.
Get rid of it. In those ways, in those words. I mean,
not
in any softer way. They had built this stuff for 2 years, and in that case, yes, indeed, with my own hands, and built it, and absolutely marvelous equipment.